few moments' time. And then at 1 o'clock, the early music show, and Catherine Bott presents a programme of music written in the city of Bologna, featuring works by some of its most famous sons. That's at one. Now, though, it's time for Private Passions. Here's Michael Barclay.
David Bintley is the artistic director of Birmingham Royal Ballet and one of Britain's finest choreographers. He trained as a dancer at the Royal Ballet School. One of his early roles was the lead in Petrushka with the Sadler's Wells Royal Ballet. Since then, he has created ballets for companies all over the world, the full-length Edward II at Stuttgart, for example. Cinderella has just been playing at the London Coliseum, and Still Life at the Penguin Cafe has been at Covent Garden. One of the things I've noticed, David, about you is that you have a very vivid relationship with music. You like working with composers.
Yes, I commissioned my first score in 1983, so I was very young. And although I've made a lot of ballets to dead composers, I prefer the live ones. Yeah, there's nothing like building a piece from the basement up. There's nothing as satisfying as creating a total work of art.
Did you, when you started as a young dancer, did movement sort of come first, or was it music inspired, as it were?
My parents were both piano players when they were young, good piano players. My dad was later then much more involved in jazz. He had his own band. My mum played in the band. So I was surrounded by music. I learned piano from them when I was young. And I used to have a fledgling record collection when I was young and when I was dancing. And I think I had a ballet worked out to every record that I had. Now, whether that's because I was interested in the movement or just the music, music has always played such an important part in my life.
I think you created a Soldier's Tale when you were 16, didn't
16,
you?
Yes, yeah. Which was pretty ambitious, I have to say. But no, again, Stravinsky was an early love.
We'll come on to BRB in a moment, which obviously plays a huge part in your life at the moment. But I think the first music was something you encountered as a teenager.
Yes, I came down to London to do the audition for the Royal Ballet School when I was about 15 or 16. And I went with my mum to the cinema to see Ken Russell's Marla. And I knew nothing about Marla at that time. I just remember this wonderful poster. And this is why we went to see it. It had this classical bust, one of those classical composer busts. But the bottom of the face had broken off, I remember. And inside, there was an open mouth screaming. So went to see this film and just fell in love with Marla. And I worked in a supermarket for 5 weeks before I went down to the Royal Ballet School for the sole purpose of buying a record player and the complete set of Marla symphonies.
So which bit are we going to hear?
It's the final few minutes of the Resurrection Symphony, number 2.
Thank you.
The closing moments of Mahler's Symphony No. 2, the Resurrection Symphony. We heard Lee Venora, the soprano, Jenny Terrell, the mezzo-soprano, with the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. I mentioned in my introduction that Petrushka had been quite an important role for you. And in fact, I think it was just about the second ballet you saw, wasn't it?
It was the second ballet that I saw. The first, of course, was The Nutcracker, because that's the first ballet everybody has to see first. But I saw it at Bradford Alhambra, I think, when I was about 13, 14. And I think it was the music more than the piece itself which captivated me. I still think it's an extraordinary, extraordinary piece. And the sound that he gets from the very... I was very torn which bit to choose of this particular piece, because the opening is so wonderful. But this particular piece, the dance of the coachman and the grooms, when I later danced the role, so I did have a sense of destiny about this piece. When you're standing in the booths in the fairground as the doll, Petrushka, at the back, the curtains are closed, and you can hear the orchestra and you can hear the whole company doing this wonderful dance. And I remember every single performance I used to get goosebumps just standing there listening to this particular section. It's an incredibly difficult role to do, I have to tell you. I once read that the great dancer Baryshnikov, who has danced, you know, every role in ballet history virtually, he said it was the hardest role that he'd ever danced, which I could sympathise with, because...
Why do you think that is?
Well, do you know, I have to confess here and now that I was physically sick on two occasions that I danced it, because to get the right kind of movement for this doll, this puppet, everything comes from the centre. So your stomach muscles are tensed for virtually 15 minutes. You start off very nervous. The booth opens, you have this very difficult dance at the beginning where you're suspended by your shoulders, so you're lifting your legs off the floor, so instantly your stomach muscles are really working overtime. Then you run forwards and you do what is called the Russian dance, where you bounce up and down, literally, your stomach is like a washing machine. You bounce up and down for 10 minutes. Then the curtains close, they quickly rush on with these two flats, they shove you through the door in these flats. The scene then is Petrushka's cell, and you're in that cell, only 20 feet or away from the audience at the front, for 10 minutes by yourself. And at the end of it, you break through the walls. You literally smash, they have paper covering the wall. Petrushka is trying to get out of his cell. You smash through the wall, and then you lean forwards and you hang on your stomach on the flat. And at one point, I nearly unloaded the contents of my stomach the other side of the flat, which wouldn't have been very nice for the next scene. But it was agony. So I didn't used to eat after breakfast if I had to do that particular role that evening.
Well, perhaps that is such a vivid description that we'll stick with the dance of the coachman and the grooms. It's so colourful, and the orchestration is so fabulous, isn't it?
Wonderful, wonderful.
We heard The Dance of the Coachman and Grooms from Stravinsky's Petrushka, the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Claudio Abbado. Do tell me, David Bentley, I'm really fascinated. Do you think that The Rite of Spring can ever be really successful as a choreographed piece? Or is it so overwhelmingly powerful as a piece of music that it's almost impossible, do you think?
Well, it is an extraordinary piece of music, isn't it? I've seen many, many versions of this ballet, and some of them are marvellous. When we did a Stravinsky series at Birmingham Royal Ballet, I didn't know which version to bring in. And I thought, really, I should go back to the beginning. And there is a reconstructed version, which I think is as close as you can ever get to the real thing. Its authenticity is disputed by some people, but I think it's a pretty close shot. And it's in the original costumes, of course, the original decor. And we did that particular version. And I wasn't that familiar with it, but I watched a lot of the rehearsals, saw the finished product, of course. And, you know, I'm not sure that I could ever see another version again. Mm. Because I thought, well, this must be as close as we can get to what happened on that night in 1913. This is the look, this is the style, this is the design that Stravinsky wrote his music to accompany. And it was quite a revelation to me.
David, you spent a lot of time at the Opera House in one way or another, and so I can't help wondering what your relationship is to opera itself.
It's a love-hate relationship. I absolutely love it and I absolutely hate it at times. My business is movement, and with the best will in the world, the business of opera, I find, is not movement. I think it's a lot better than it was, and there are some very, very fantastic producers, and of course, I love the sound of opera more than the visuals. But I'm also very... I don't tend to go for one composer. I love The Ring Cycle and I love Tristan, but I spent an interminable number of hours watching a Meistersinger in Japan on my birthday. Why did I do that to myself? I just hated every single second of it. The same with Verdi. I love Otello. I love Traviata. Aida just leaves me cold. It just doesn't work for me. And this is my kind of relationship with opera. There are certain works which I absolutely love. And
but is that true of ballet too? I mean, that there are certain...
Most definitely. Yeah, most yeah. definitely. I mean, I wouldn't mind if I never saw Swan Lake ever again. But I've seen my fair share of Swan Lakes in my time. Oh, no, definitely. There are, great as those works are, you have to make a choice in the end. You know, do I want to spend 5 hours of my life watching Meistersinger again? No, I won't do that again.
Well, the opera you have chosen, you've already mentioned, is Otello, which, of course, is a great score.
Mm-hmm. And, again, one of my favourite plays of Shakespeare. And it's a marvellous version. It's a wonderful music theatre version. And some people say it's better than Othello. I don't see how that could be the case. But it certainly has a speed and a pace, which at times... I miss when I'm watching the play. The same for Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. Whenever I see the play of Romeo and Juliet, I miss the music. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes. Yeah. And of course, with something like the emotion of jealousy, music can insinuate itself in a way and add another dimension,
yes,
can't it?
Yes. Well, I mean, Verdi's Iago is as great musically as Shakespeare's is verbally.
Sì,
The finale of Act Two of Verdi's Otello, Placido Domingo and Sergei Leifukus as Otello and Iago, with the orchestra of the Opera Bastille, directed by Myung-Whun Chung. The next composer, David Bintley, is one who actually has been, if one regards this piece as a successful ballet, has been successful in opera and ballet, but is probably best known as an opera composer, and that's Benjamin Britten.
Yes, I've included this because in any list of music that is of great interest to me, the piece that I'm working on at the moment would have to be in there. And I am doing a version of this for my other company in Japan, the National Ballet of Japan, which goes on in October in Tokyo. This is a strange piece by Britten. This is the longest piece of instrumental music that he wrote. And he called it his problem child.
Well, of course, we're talking about Britten's only ballet, Prince of the Pagodas.
Yes, and it has had a very strange, very checkered history. For me, the problem has always lain in the scenario. And because Britten was such a good dramatist musically, his music fits what is a very poor scenario perfectly. So it's actually quite difficult to change the story because the music follows it so hard. So I've spent many, many years trying to work out a way to make this piece work. And Japan has actually given me the key. I was over there working 2 or 3 years ago, and I suddenly thought, pagodas would be interesting here. I mean, this is Japan, you know. And I started thinking of it as a Japanese piece, and influenced by Japanese art, particularly by Kuniyoshi, a great ukiyo-e artist or woodblock artist. And I suddenly found in his work all of the elements that are in the Britten. But I did rewrite the story slightly.
Well, it'd be fascinating to see it. I hope it'll come here.
Yes, but it's actually a co-production between the National Ballet of Japan and Birmingham Royal Ballet.
So we will see it.
Yes. Hopefully, yes, yes.
Well, which bit shall we listen to now?
Well, I think this is a wonderful bit. It's the coda to what is the kind of water or Belle Rose travels through the elements of water, air and fire. And here she's travelling through the elements.
It's an elliptical score, isn't it, actually?
It's an extraordinary score. And one thing that's striking me all the way through these pieces I'm listening to is all these people, Mahler, Stravinsky, Verdi, Britten, they're all marvellous orchestrators.
There's some extraordinary sounds there.
Yes. I think he did his homework very well on this piece. Tchaikovsky is in the background. Stravinsky is in the background. So he took the best of the ballet composers. And I think he really did his homework.
That was the Prince of the Pagodas, Act 2, Coda to the Water section by Benjamin Britten. And we heard the London Sinfonietta conducted by Oliver Nussen. David, just talk a little bit about what BRB means, because I think the fact that it's not in London, that it is a company that is very central to a particular city, is incredibly important to the people that live there, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's one of the great pleasures of directing that company, because we're not just a company that puts on ballets. We are a fundamental part of the arts and culture in the city, of course, but educationally we do an awful lot of work.
I mean, presumably where London is almost amorphous in the size and the number of sort of communities, there is an identifiable community in Birmingham.
Yes, of course, and it's much smaller. And we are one of the jewels in the crown, along with the CBSO, City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. And so we're not competing with so many other arts organisations for the attention of the people of Birmingham and the surrounding area. They took us to their hearts, really, back in 1990, and have supported us not only in the accessible work that we do, but also in the challenging work that we do. And of course, we see it as being very important to be really a part of the community. You know, I used to get asked frequently, you know, of course you live in London. I said, no, we live in Birmingham. The whole company lives in Birmingham. That's who we are. That's what we are. People often make the mistake of calling us the Royal Ballet, and we have to correct them and say we're the Birmingham Royal Ballet. You know, so being part of that community, being more than just doing the shows, is very important to us.
Well, one of the most moving things I've seen on television, I think, in recent years, was that Romeo and Juliet, which you did with deprived kids.
Yeah.
And what it meant to them to take on roles where they had to be disciplined, and that they suddenly realised what dancers do and how incredibly taxing it is. But it transformed their lives, didn't it?
I think it transformed our lives as well. These young people who came from incredibly challenging backgrounds, they spent almost 2 years working on this project, and it literally did change lives. We got some of those kids housed. Some of them were on the streets. We got most of them back into education because most of them had dropped out of education. We kept one boy out of prison at one point because I won't go into details, but he'd drawn a knife on somebody, and the judge had said, I'm going to let you off, but you stay with this project. It was extraordinary. And, you know, we find time and time again that what dance does, because it's on the body, it's on your body, it's you moving. This releases a kind of confidence and a stretching of the imagination of lots of kids who are just stunted in that way, who have no opportunity to express
themselves. So it's a physical outlet for turbulence.
It is, yes.
Well, let's go back a little bit further now, because, of course, you were a creature of the 60s in some ways, and so naturally you have a love of pop music, David Bintley.
I do love pop music. The 60s was I was very, very young, but gosh, I remember the Beatles and the Stones, all of that. And all through my life, as indeed I think through everybody's life, what pop music does is it just evokes, you know, not just a decade, but a specific year, a summer, you know, the summer of love. Mm. And pop music does that, and great music doesn't really. But, yeah, pop does.
Well, one of the icons of that period was, of course, Bob Dylan. But in fact, you've actually chosen a Brian Ferry recording.
Well, you know, it's Brian Ferry, not so much Bob Dylan. Mm. I remember when Roxy Music first appeared on Top of the Pops, I can see it now. It was like these guys came down from Mars. They didn't look like anybody else. They didn't sound like anybody else. And I have to say, in all honesty, I've just followed them and Brian Ferry and his remarkable way of selecting other people's songs and making them sound completely his own. I've followed them since 1972.
I could offer you a warm embrace, to make you feel my love. When evening shadows and the stars appear, and there is no one to dry your tears, I could hold you for a million years to make you feel my love. I know you haven't made your mind up yet, but I would never do you wrong. I've known it from the moment that we met, no doubt in my mind where you belong. I would go hungry, I'd go black and blue, I'd go crawling down the avenue. There's nothing that I wouldn't do to make you feel my love. Storms are raging on the rolling sea and on the highway of regret. The winds of change are blowing wild and free. You ain't seen nothing like me yet. I could make you happy, make your dreams come true. Nothing that I wouldn't do. Go to the ends of the earth for you, to make you feel my love.
It's a beautiful song, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Song. Make You Feel My Love, a Bob Dylan number, but recreated there by Brian Ferry. The next music we're going to hear, David Bintley, I think is important to you, partly from the way it uses the idea of contemporary religious music, but also a composer you came to originally through an orchestral score.
Yes, I remember the Confession of Isabel Gowdy. I think it was the first piece I'd ever heard by Macmillan, and it was on the prom, and I was in the car at the time, and I had to pull over. It was an astonishing debut, I think, almost like a fully formed voice.
And especially the opening movement of it is very arresting.
Yes, and then, of course, I realised that Jimmy's faith was so strong in his work, and that's a faith that I share as well, the Catholic faith. And I'm very, very interested in how contemporary music, that there has been this kind of religious movement recently in it, with composers like John Taverner, of course, and Arvo Pärt, mm-hmm. Yes. And the very different way that people are coming at it. But also, I'm very interested in its acceptance, because it seems to me, you know, there is obviously religion has played a huge part in the literature of music over the years. And it seems to me that even in this increasingly secular, even atheistic age, composers of deep faith can dedicate most of their output to music which is informed by that, and they're taken seriously. Because in so many other walks of life, especially nowadays, religion is received with it's embarrassment, or it's ridiculed, or one is kind of deemed to be rather simple or an idiot if one is a person of faith, or perhaps even a dangerous person. You know, but in music, these composers are very serious composers and taken seriously, and their work is judged seriously.
The music we're going to hear is from Macmillan's Seven Last Words from the Cross.
Yes, I remember when it was first done, because it was done on TV, I think, over a week during Holy Week. I remember something very interesting that Jimmy said once when he talked about Holy Week. And in the Catholic faith, this is very vividly dramatised. In this particular section, the wooden cross is brought into the church, and three times it's stopped, and the congregation says, "This is the wood of the cross on which our Saviour died." And then at the end of the service, the whole of the congregation is invited to come and embrace the cross. So it's very dramatic, and of course Catholic liturgy is. It's one of the great beauties of the Catholic liturgy. And I remember him saying that, you know, at times, Holy Week, it's like it's happening. You look around and you look around at the people, and it's like it's happening again, there and then. It's so vividly kind of drawn. And this particular piece of music really brought that occasion to me.
Verily I say unto thee, today thou shalt be with me in paradise. That was the third of the seven last words from the cross by James Macmillan. Verily I say unto thee, today thou shalt be with me in paradise. The Britten Sinfonia and Polyphony were directed by Stephen Layton. Now, you mentioned earlier, David Lintley, that your father had a great penchant for jazz, and I think it's in tribute to that partially that we're going to hear the next piece, but also it's something you love.
Yes, my dad had a band, seven-piece at its largest, and they used to practice in our house. And most of the records that my parents had were jazz records, so I really was surrounded by it when I was a youngster. And latterly, I did a couple of ballets to music by Duke Ellington, and really it's the big band sound that I like, and particularly Ellington. But this is a great piece because it's another great band, the Count Basie Band, of course. It's the two bands together playing this remarkable Frank West piece called Seguin C.
They were having fun.
Yeah, it's so genial, isn't it? It's great. You can
the Duke Ellington Band and Count Basie and his orchestra getting together for Segue in C by Frank West. In fact, Frank West was playing the flute on that.
Mm-hmm.
And also marvellous contribution from Lewis Blackburn with the plunger trombone.
Yes, fabulous.
Finally, David Bintley, a composer that I think you're working with at the moment or about to, Australian composer.
Yes, Matthew Heinzen. Matthew is kind of representative of all the great composers that I've worked with. As I said earlier, one of the biggest pleasures that I have is working with composers, making something from the ground up. And Matthew, we worked together about a year and a half ago on a piece called E equals MC squared, which was shaped around the special theory of relativity. And we're working on a piece at the moment which will be called Faster, Higher, Stronger, which is the Olympic motto. So this will go on just before the Olympics next year.
And which piece of his have you chosen for us to hear?
This is the second movement of his violin concerto. It's called Westaway. And Matthew is a composer who is very influenced by modern pop music.
Hmm.
The first piece that I heard of his was a piece called Headbanger, which I thought was a joke. Quite often, listening to unusual music, I'm not sure how to approach it. But I heard this piece called Headbanger, which was techno music, but played on an orchestra. This is a little more conventional here, but one of his very contemplative and spiritual pieces.
Thank you.
Westaway from the Violin Concerto No. 1, Australian Postcards, by Matthew Heinzen. We heard Naoko Miyamoto playing the violin with the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Kenneth Young. It's very interesting how Australian composers absorbed things from the East as well as the West, I find.
Yes, it struck me then listening to that, it was not so much a lark ascending as a kookaburra ascending for a moment there.
Yeah. It's more like wonderful Australian food, that it has a strong Asian influence.
Yes.
If you were somewhere like Sydney, you somehow realise you're at a different hub in the world.
Yeah. Well, it's Asia, isn't it? I mean, it's Australasia, but it's that side of the world.
Well, David Bentley, we'll look forward to that collaboration. Meanwhile, thank you very much for letting us hear your private passions.
Thank you.
Michael Barclay was talking this week to David Bentley, and next Sunday, as part of Radio 3's celebration of light music, Michael Barclay will be introducing a selection of relevant pieces chosen by previous guests on the programme, including Joanna Lumley, Mark Ravenhill, Al Murray and Dame Edna Everidge. That's at the usual time, 12 o'clock next Sunday. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. And talking about our light, fantastic weekend coming up next weekend, Donald MacLeod will be exploring that world in Composer of the Week this week with his special studio guest, the singer, conductor and broadcaster Brian Kay. And this, the introductory programme on Monday, attempts to answer the question, what is light music? And introduces some of the central composers, conductors and orchestras in the genre.
It's not about the money, money, money.
Nothing quite as wonderful as money.
On BBC Radio 3, Money Talks.
Radio 3's Money Talk season continues with a new adaptation for Drama on 3.
When I was poor, I hated the world. Now I am rich, I despise it.
Edward Bulwer-Lytton's satirical comedy Money was the talk of 19th century London. And for 2011, Samuel West makes his radio directorial debut in a new production recorded for Radio 3 at the playwright's home, Nebworth House in Hertfordshire.
Run! Run on the bank! Run!
With Roger Allam, Celia Imrie and Ian McDermott. Money, our drama on 3. Tonight at 8 on BBC Radio 3.
We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news from Vaughan Savage.
Lawyers for the Church of England are advising that openly gay clergy should be allowed to become bishops. They've been reviewing church policy in the light of the Equality Act, which gives protection from discrimination on the grounds of sexuality. Their guidance will be sent to members of the General Synod. It's thought that the guidance will say that gay clergy should be asked to confirm that they are not in a sexual relationship. NATO has said it will take some time to establish whether its planes bombed a residential area of the Libyan capital Tripoli last night, killing 5 people. The Libyan government called the deaths cold-blooded murder. NATO said it regretted any loss of civilian life and insisted it went to great lengths to avoid such casualties. The Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, has accused ministers of seeking confrontation by announcing changes to public sector pensions before talks with the unions have finished. The government has said pension reforms are unavoidable, but should be achieved through negotiation. Eurozone finance ministers meet in Luxembourg later to discuss a second bailout package for Greece. Demonstrators are planning a big rally in Athens to protest at austerity measures. The peace campaigner Brian Hoare, who camped in Parliament Square in London for 10 years, has died at the age of 62. His family said he had died in Germany, where he'd been receiving treatment for lung cancer. The ivory dress worn by Marilyn Monroe in The 7 Year Itch has sold for £3.5 million at an auction in Los Angeles. The dress was part of a collection of film memorabilia amassed by the 79-year-old actress Debbie Reynolds over 4 decades. The price included a £600,000 commission. The weather: cloudy with outbreaks of showery rain, occasionally heavy across southern Scotland, northern and eastern England. Mainly dry and bright across northern Scotland. Elsewhere, a mixture of bright spells and scattered, mainly light showers. The BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
And now the second of this weekend's early music shows, presented by Catherine Bott.
Oh, Mezzo-soprano Judith Malafronte with lutenist Kevin Mason in a 14th-century madrigal, Non al suo amante, words by Petrarch, music by Jacopo di Bologna. As you may guess from his name, the northern Italian city of Bologna was Jacopo's patch, and it's also the focus of today's early music show. Bologna is the capital city of the Emilia-Romagna region, situated in the Po Valley between the Po River and the Apennine Mountains, and it's twinned with our own city of Coventry. It's home to the oldest university in the world, founded in 1088, and is one of the wealthiest cities in Italy, not only financially but also in terms of its rich history in the arts, culture and cuisine. I'd be willing to bet that most students of Coventry or Warwick universities could knock up a spag bol in a bedsit kitchen, although the dish might not win any gastronomic awards in the city of its creation. And while we're on the subject of food, Bologna is also the origin of mortadella, a sausage dating back to Roman times, which is traditionally flavoured with myrtle berries and pistachios. Yum, yum. But enough of food. What about the Bolognese taste in music? One of the city's most famous musical sons was Adriano Banchieri. He was born there in 1568 and became a Benedictine monk at the age of 23. He travelled throughout Italy, but eventually settled in a monastery near Bologna in 1607, where he remained until his death 27 years later. Despite his clear devotion to God and to the church, Banchieri actually left us a remarkably small amount of religious music. There is plenty of keyboard music, though, so let's hear Rinaldo Alessandrini on the organ in this short Battaglia. Rinaldo Alessandrini, playing one of Banchieri's keyboard battaglias. Banchieri really enjoyed putting the madrigal form to dramatic use. In fact,